Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Bienvenidos. Before I begin the introductions today, just two housekeeping notes. One, everybody, please turn off your cell phones now, or at least put them on mute. We do record this and put it up on our website. And it's a nuisance for everybody if you can't quite hear a particularly insightful comment because somebody's cell phone was going off. So if you could all please check your phones now. Second of all, I'd like to tell you about our next lunch, and that'll be next Monday. And it's Professor O.A. Westad of the London School of Economics. He is a former research director for the Nobel Prizes. He's a Norwegian scholar. He's written a very interesting book on China entitled Restless Empire, China and the World Since 1750. And I recommend it to all of you. I suspect there might be a lot of overlap in the audiences. With that, I'd like to introduce to you our speaker today. Juan Pablo Cardenal is a Spanish journalist who has written a book that's already received excellent reviews on Silent Army, How China is Building Its Global Power from the Ground Up. His co-author is here with us, Heriberto Araujo. The two of them traveled to 25 countries in the process of researching this. It's one of the most comprehensive efforts anyone has seen to look at not only China's public diplomacy, but also what is the track record of Chinese companies around the world, as they, particularly in emerging markets. So with that, I'd like to give you Juan Pablo.
Thank you, Keith, for the introduction. Thank you to the FCC for hosting us, and to all of you for your interest in our work. I would like to start by arguing that more than a book, I think what we have here is a way of life. When we got started with this in 2009, it took us 25 countries and 2 years to work in this project. I remember the last couple of months when we were writing this book, I hated myself for getting involved in such a project because of the challenges and the intellectual effort that we were doing at the time. But of course, just a few, and I remember also promising myself I would never write a book on this again, you know. But only a couple of months later, we were involved in a second project, our current project, which is China's approach to the West. So overall, during the last 4 years, we have been looking in around 40 countries, what is China doing abroad? And that's why I say that more than a book is a way of life. And my wife, who is sitting here, I'm sure she can tell you a lot about this. But anyway, we're here to introduce this book, China's Silent Army, which is a book that approaches one of the hottest issues on the world today, which is China's rise and its eruption into the international stage. The objective of this investigation was to understand and describe how is China becoming a global power and the impact of it at local level. Let me very briefly draw a roadmap of what I'm going to be presenting today. I'm going to start with the motivation, why this book is important, continue with the description of the field research. We'll include a 5-minute homemade video in which you will see with images what is it exactly that we did. I'll continue by answering the question, what is happening on the ground and what is China's strategy and why is China succeeding? Follow up by the conclusions in which we will answer who is really taking the profit, and we will end up with a Q&A. In respect of the motivation, this field research is probably the first one done on this scale, at this scale on this topic. And the reason why, there are three reasons why I believe this book and this work is important. First of all, because there's not much that we know about China's international expansion. And this is because of the discrete nature of the Chinese people, because of the opaque nature of China's political system, and because the expansion comes with the silence of money. The second reason why I believe this book is important is because China is changing the world, is changing international politics, it's changing the global economy, our business, our lives. Just to give you an example, China joined the WTO in 2001, and one decade later, in 2010, the trade of China with the rest of the world had multiplied by six and reached $2.97 trillion. I checked this morning to see if I could find an updated figure on this, and I realized that since 2010 till today, in the last 2 years, this China has become the world's biggest trading nation, and the overall trade of China with the rest of the world has jumped to $3.82 trillion. The third reason why I think this book is important is because it fills a gap, the gap by giving voice to the local populations. When my co-author and I were sharing office in Beijing, we would see every day on a daily basis small pieces of information on the news. With a loan, a huge Chinese loan somewhere in the world, or a huge Chinese investment, always with a huge figure behind it, and most of the times with a lot of win-win situation rhetoric, but no information at all of what was really happening on the ground. I think one of the big contributions of this project is that we give voice to all those people and to the people that are suffering or benefiting out of Chinese investment and presence. Couple of things on the field research. As I said, 25 countries in the developing world, Africa, Latin America, Central Asia, Southeast Asia, and a touch of the Middle East. That's where China secures its future supplies of natural resources. It was an adventure of 2,035,000 kilometers. We jumped into 80 airplanes, crossed 11 land borders, and it took 2 years of our lives. We did around, it's, by the way, a self-financed project. We did around 500 interviews, politicians, businessmen, workers, diplomats, scholars, activists, both Chinese and non-Chinese. And the purpose of such a field research is that because we didn't want to do an anecdotic field research, and we also wanted to capture the behavior patterns across the planet. Let me show you this 5 minute video.
Actually, the key cause, the underlying and obvious cause of this timber business activity in Russia, in Russian Far East, is Chinese unlimited demand of timber. It's an impact to Indonesian forest and Siberian forest equally.
People became unemployed. They usually get to together in a group and go to the forest because they clearly know the Chinese wholesalers of timber are here in any village. They can just pay cash dollars for just good, valuable logs.
Actually, about 10 to 12 trains of timber, each consisting of 60 cars, across the border from Russian Far East to Suphenhe. And actually, that means that it's about 3,000 cubic meters every day are coming to Suphenhe train station and enter Chinese timber market.
Okay, so what is happening? What did we find? Basically, that China is succeeding and that China is everywhere. The driver, as I mentioned, is the hand of natural resources. That's why that took us to the oil wells in Sudan, to the jade mines in Burma, the iron ore mines in Peru, the gas fields in Turkmenistan, the cobalt and copper mines in Congo, and the forests of Siberia, just to mention a few. And there are two levels of investment. One is the private sector, and the other one is official China. In regards of the private sector, we are talking of an army of small entrepreneurs, small businessmen, migrant workers, that we've seen them conquering impossible markets in the most remote areas of the world. They do business in the textile industry, retail, construction services, and agriculture mainly. And they are able to conquer those markets thanks to the attributes that are common to the Chinese people. Just to name a few, sharp business sense, readiness and willingness to sacrifice, talent to put the cost down, adaptation to the environment, and the web of intra-Chinese contacts. The second level of investment, the really important one, is official China. And why is China succeeding? Pure and simple, two words, state capitalism. And let me give you three examples. First of all is the almost unlimited financial resources that China has. This is key in the current context of crisis. During the period 2009 and 2010, China overtook the World Bank as the world's banker by giving countries between around $110 billion. On top of that, the China Development Bank, just to name another example, granted Venezuela with $40 billion US dollars in the last few years. And in terms of FDI, foreign investment, China has invested from 2005 to 2013, till now, around $600 billion US dollars. The second aspect of this state capitalism is that China is building infrastructure projects a la carte. as one minister in Zambia put it to us, he gave us a quote that I believe explains very well why those infrastructures are so appealing in the developing world, especially in Africa. This minister said, "If I don't build a road, I don't get reelected. If I do build a road, I am a hero." And I think this explains very well what is the sentiment there. Probably the best example that we came across was Angola, where after 27 years of war, hundreds of Chinese companies are building, almost from scratch, roads, railways, housing, hospitals, etc. And as it was mentioned in the video, China is at this present time building around 300 dams across around the world. The third aspect of this state capitalism is what we call China's seductive diplomacy, which means that they've been very active in building alliances with countries that are confronted with the West in a way or another. The best example that we saw on the ground was Iran. When we were there a few weeks after the UN sanctions to Iran, the way in which China is playing and being diplomatically a very, very chameleonic is very well explained with Iran. What they did is, first of all, they don't support unilateral sanctions like the US, European, or other sanctions. They don't support that at all. And in respect of the UN sanctions, they do support them, but only after delaying them and after watering them down. So this is good enough for the international community, and China is seen as a responsible actor. But on the other hand, China offers itself to Tehran as a diplomatic ally because of this watering down thing. And then at the same, as well as being a diplomatic ally, China is offering itself as a business partner ready to invest and to give loans. The result of this is that China has overtaken its competitors in the fourth largest oil-producing country in the world and has become the main and most important player there. In respect of our conclusions, I'm going to give you four. First of all is official China's approach and strategy in the developing world is legitimate, and all the good things that come along cannot be minimized. We've seen how important it is for the developing world, all those infrastructures and all this financing that China is giving. And in the context of the crisis in the last 4 or 5 years, China's demand of natural resources has made a big impact on those countries' GDP. Second conclusion is that this strategy comes with side effects. No added value to the local economies, corruption, bad business practices, and no transparency, and most important, low social, environmental, and labor standards. Best example on this last part was when we were in Zambia, we witnessed in Zambia. It's a country where China is investing heavily, and also is always highlighted as the best example of Sino-African cooperation. But when we were on the ground on the Copper Belt area, we realized that the Chinese are not so much welcome. And basically the reason why they are not so welcome is because of the very poor labor conditions that they are giving in their projects, clearly the worst among the foreign investors. So what happened a few months after we were in Zambia is that the opposition party leader won the elections and became Zambia's president after running a campaign with a very anti-Chinese speech that gave him a lot of votes in this Copper Belt area. Third conclusion is that in a way China is exporting its model. And it's able to do so because there's no checks and balances either in China and in many of the countries where China is investing. This means no rule of law, or very weak rule of law, no civil society, and weak institutions many times mean suffering that is being paid by the weakest of all. Last conclusion is we ask ourselves, who is taking the profit? We definitely believe that the Chinese investors are taking the profit and the local elites are also taking the profit. But we believe that the local populations aren't always the winners here. Locally, there's a perception that China is investing there in its own benefit only. And the reasons for this is the no added value, the engagement with the elites only, and the very poor labor conditions. I guess that with this you have an overall picture of what we've been doing in the last few years. And let me please finish with a quote by Deng Xiaoping, which I believe explains very well the current state of affairs in China's international expansion. It was a quote that he said just after the Tiananmen massacre, and he said the following: "Observe and analyze calmly, secure our position, tackle changes patiently, hide our abilities and wait for the right moment, keep a low profile, never claim leadership, carry out business modestly." Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Juan Pablo. Who would like to ask the first question, given that overview? Here, please. Please wait for the microphone and introduce yourself.
Juan Pablo, I think you are too modest about writing this book, you know. You didn't tell us about all the risks to your health, to your life, that you took in writing this book. Could you just tell us the story, I think, from going from Angola to Congo in the taxi? Could you just recall this episode to give people a flavor of the risk you took? Thank you.
Well, it was a lot of traveling, but not for holidays, you know. This episode was when crossing from Cabinda in Angola to Democratic Republic of Congo. We made a couple of mistakes, like trying to cross that border on a public holiday. But what happened on that time, we were four of us, both of us plus a photographer and a Chinese friend of ours, and we were crossing one of the most dangerous borders in the world, where there's been problems in the past, and the guards in one of the borders were high on alcohol and drugs, and we were traveling on tourist visas, we're carrying, I don't remember, four, five, six laptops, several hard disks, five or six different cameras. So we were not really, although we said that we were celebrating Spain's victory on the football world championship, of course it didn't make any sense, you know. But after paying a small bribe and suffering basically not for our lives, but more for, we were very concerned about all the work that we were carrying with us, you know. But after we were able to enter Congo, we went on another episode, which is traveling in all those, I think that probably traveling in those countries has been the most dangerous thing that we've done. I mean, I remember, this was a 400 kilometer, 10 to 12 hours in a car. And every time we crossed with a lorry passed, I was thinking that we were gonna end up, that we're gonna crash with that truck, you know. And then you end up arriving in Kinshasa, and then the hotel, you pay, I think we were paying like 100 euro per night in a terrible hotel with a very unique audience in the disco, people with guns, no running water, mosquitoes, no internet. So it was, as I say, not too much fun.
They say the death rate.
Yes, I think, I don't know if it's because Juan Pablo's wife is here and he forgot a very important episode. I will never forget is that once we crossed to DRC, we got kind of kidnapped by two policemen. They were supposed to be policemen because they were in plain clothes, and we stayed at the police station over 4 or 5 hours until we were able to call the Spanish consulate, and they kind of freed us. So yeah, it has been a very difficult trip, this one in DRC.
WHO, I think, says that the death rate in developing countries as a whole per million vehicle miles is 50 times what it is in the U.S., and it's probably higher, unfortunately, in Africa. Just to give a more of a policy question, do you see more countries in Africa following the example that you cited in Zambia of electing candidates who are campaigning on anti-Chinese or at least anti-Chinese investment positions. Is that the beginning of a continent-wide trend, or is Zambia sort of an outlier because there's been so much mining investment there that tends to be particularly destructive?
Well, I think China is already facing some problems in other places, in Africa in particular. I think part of it has to do with the fact that I believe that China has a peer problem. They are not even explaining all the good things that they are doing. But I think in terms of if other politicians elsewhere in the continent are doing such a thing, well, I'm not very sure because, we don't hear at least about it, because what China is doing is engaging with the elites only, and the elites are very happy with the Chinese, you know. So answering your question, I haven't seen, I don't know you, Roberto, if you know anything, but I don't remember any case exactly like this. But what we are foreseeing is that China will face problems in the future unless it changes its approach.
Tara?
The example I think I would look at now is not in Africa, but in Latin America, and is Venezuela, in which you have China, thanks to Chavez's regime or Chavez democracy, investing and giving loans for over 40 billion in a 6-7 years period. And now you have Chavez who is dead, and you have new elections with a opposition candidate that might be the new president. So everyone, of course, is in China asking questions about what's going to happen to these investments and these loans if Capriles win the election, if there is a change of regime. I think it's an interesting thing, and I think also China is taking and learning a lot of lessons of the Spring or Arab Revolution in the northern part of Africa. Libya is a good example to see what's going on. Egypt, we don't have to forget that according to Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Chinese companies lost over 20 billion just in Libya because of the Gaddafi falling regime.
Keith, one other thing. Surprisingly enough, when Michael Sata became the president of Zambia, the first thing he did is his first reception was with the Chinese ambassador. And he, after a couple of weeks, he completely changed his rhetoric against the Chinese. So I think probably we could imagine that he used that as a strategy to become the president of Zambia also.
Tara?
I guess just following on from what Keith is asking, clearly you've roved the world and put yourself at risk to highlight this trend. And what do you see as the next stage of this? Is it something that's going to peter out? Are we going to see a lot of reaction globally? Are we going to see Western governments taking a stand on it? What do you see actually happening?
I mean, what I see is what is already happening, which is China is perceived in many parts of the world, including Europe, as the country that has to help us out of the crisis. And then other countries is also perceive China as the country where, I mean, all the opportunities are coming through China. You know, so I see really a much more engagement, and I think that this process that we've researched on is going to continue, and it's going to become a global thing. You know, the issue here is that if China is going to be able to, its state-owned companies are going to be able to do business in a different way. Because if they don't do them in a different way and explain better all the good things that they do, I think they're going to be facing violence and problems as we've seen in several countries in our research.
Okay, let's open the floor. Robin here.
Hi, Robin Meredith. You've described a lot of the bad things that happen in individual countries, yet you say that there is some good. Taken as a whole, if we look at the development pattern of foreign investors going into China, eventually hundreds of millions of people were lifted out of poverty. But Can you enlighten us on whether you see a similar benefit happening to countries that China invests in? Because I have the impression so far that actually not much of the money invested by China in these developing countries is helping individual people on average there.
So, sorry, the question is?
The question is China's investment in these developing countries on average making people who live there better off, or no change?
I mean, I would argue that the picture is mixed, you know. And even in one particular country, the picture is also mixed. So when we were in Sudan, for instance, China is the biggest, I would say probably the only big investor there. And starting from the pipeline that allows Sudan's oil to go out of the country, and also the Merowe Dam in the Nile River, which will have apparently an impact on developing agriculture in the north of the country, and all the roads and the infrastructures that come with this project, that's definitely something that is going to help development in the country. We don't deny that. But for instance, in this Merowe Dam, we were able to follow the story of the people that have been relocated by force because of this dam. This dam is the biggest engineering project of China in Africa. And those 90,000 people that have been forced to relocate elsewhere and pushed to extreme poverty, they are never in the picture. So answering your question, I would say that it depends from country to country. Of course, there's an economic impact, and in a way, it helps development. But sometimes, in terms of infrastructure, many of the roads, for instance, are because they want to start a project related to natural resources, and they need to take all those resources out. Who is going to benefit out of this road? The people in the surrounding area. The other thing that I think, and that's a very strong point that we make on the book, is the issue of the no added value. It's a common pattern that, as far as we saw at least, that the Chinese are getting the natural resources and shipping them back to China. So all the added value goes to the Chinese economy. But at the same time, we also argue that this is not something that we could blame the Chinese only. I mean, because this is something that the local governments could easily be requiring China to invest on processing industries in the same way that China has been requiring foreign investors to do so in the last 30 years. But again, just to finalize, I think that, of course, there are people that benefit, but I think the ones that benefit most are the elites.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. You sort of touched on one of my questions, but I wanted to ask you, did you go to Zimbabwe? And if not, why not? And on the question of these infrastructure developments, I mean, you sort of addressed the question, which is, to what degree are these infrastructure projects things that these nations would need to benefit people? Hospitals is a good example. But if you're building infrastructure, the purpose of which is the extraction of resources, and you wouldn't be able to get those resources unless you built the infrastructure, then it seems a less generous approach. So on balance, how do you see those infrastructure developments?
The reason why we didn't go to Zimbabwe is because we had to choose, you know, among the 193 or 94 countries in the world, 25. We didn't go, for instance, to Brazil either, and I think it was probably one of the things we had to do. We also didn't want to distort reality. We already went to Sudan, to Turkmenistan, to Burma, to Cuba, to Iran, to DRC. So we didn't want just to pick up countries that were having troubles with the West. I think on the issue of the infrastructures, of course, you need to go country by country, but I think a very good example would be the Chinese deal with DRC is this very famous, originally $9 billion US dollar package that Chinese state-owned companies and state-owned policy banks mainly offered to DRC. Finally, this deal was reduced to $6 billion. And what you see mainly is what Juan Pablo was explaining. China came, put the money, offer technology, labor hand, and in a way, a la carte project of infrastructure. And in exchange, they only demand access to the copper resources in Lubumbashi, in the border with Zambia, very near from the copper belt. Well, what you see is that, yes, hospitals are being built, universities, university buildings are being built, roads are being built, but at the end of the day, you don't have doctors to fill these hospitals, you don't have electricity to run those hospitals, you don't have beds to put in those hospitals. So you find that many of those infrastructures, despite China is doing it, you know, they are real, they are white elephants. And I was talking with one local politician in DRC, in Kinshasa, and he was very candid, I think, and he really understood why it was not so beneficial for Congo. And he said, listen, we cannot, we can't think here in Africa that we are Chinese. It's not because we are going to have infrastructure that we are going to have development. There are two different things. In China, infrastructure has been key because China became a major producer and a major exporter to the world, and they wanted to attract foreign investment, and they have human and capital. But here in Africa, the situation is much different. The people who is voting me, 95% of them are illiterate. If you build a road from this village to those to the other village, you know, nothing's going to change. You need to start from much earlier. So he was kind of reluctant to think that this was going to bring development to his country.
The other thing I would say is that there's a lot of complaint about the quality of the infrastructures, because even in places where the infrastructure has made a difference, when roads are falling apart around 5 years after they have been built. That's at least a concern locally.
I'm Angus Forsyth. China has been busily setting up around the world so-called Confucius Institutes. Have they been established in any of the countries you've been looking at? And on a wider basis, do you see any sort of underlying mission behind this movement and what its future might be?
The issues of the Confucius Institute, we consider at the beginning to have a look at this. I think it's a bit exaggerated to think that there is a... I mean, it's clear. We've seen the textbooks they use, and the issues like Tiananmen or the Cultural Revolution is not explained as it is explained in other parts of the world. But I wouldn't say there is a hidden agenda or whatever. I think it's a way to influence. It's also a way to have kind of a soft power. But I think that people who are going or joining the Confucius Institute, they are doing it mainly for to learn the language, to learn Chinese.
Am I missing anybody over here? Suppose I do. Okay. Over here, please. And then Bettina.
Yes, Paloma, a Spanish journalist. Two questions. The first one, is China learning? Because obviously they are being very much aware of what is happening, and they have a lot of academics studying into this. Is China learning? What is the trend for the investment in the future? Let's say instead of arriving there with an army of laborers, by companies, for instance, in Europe or in other parts of the world. And the second question is, how is the interaction with the local populations you found? The local populations in Latin America or in Africa are rejecting them, are interchanging, are marrying between themselves?
I'm going to start with the second one. In Africa, I mean, where we've seen more Chinese labor force is in Africa, and not so many in Latin America, despite the fact that China is investing very heavily in Latin America. The reason is because I think the Latin American governments have more leverage to tell the Chinese that they cannot accept the Chinese labor force. But in Africa, it's not the same. And one thing that happened, we've witnessed over and over again, is that in a Chinese project, which is running for, let's say, 3 years with 3,000 Chinese workers, the perception outside this site is that the Chinese are not willing to engage with the local population or to interact. And even some people have mentioned the issue of, well, they never go out of the site, so therefore they are probably prisoners. We tried to look to this, if we found any evidence of that. We didn't find any. But then when you talk to the Chinese workers in the stadium or in the project itself, they will tell you, well, I'm here for 2-3 years. I'm working 6-7 days a week. I want to get this finished. I don't speak the language. I don't know the area. And I want to save all the money that I'm getting paid. So this, on one side, on outside the site, is perceived as they are probably prisoners, but inside the site, there's a very logical explanation. But that's one part of the reaction by the locals. The other is I think the Chinese are perceived as dangerous when they are being their competitors. So, for instance, in the retail, if they are competing with the locals, then of course they dislike that. But I think they would dislike it in the same way if it would be any other nationality.
Trend. I mean, you mentioned Europe, and I think...
I think that my question is, are they learning? Are they changing strategies for not causing so much trouble to their investment?
I think we could use one example that is mentioned in the first book, and we are working also on the second book, that is Huawei, and how Huawei has been sophisticating its strategy, using much more, PR budget, trying to use lobbies both in the US and in Europe to improve their company's image, and probably that's going to be the thing they are going to do. The only issue I see on the long term difficult for Chinese companies to change is this issue of labor conditions and importing labor hand. I mean, the reason why some of those companies are able to get into sectors in which the Western technology, for instance, in the oil and gas sector, is much developed, is because they are bringing their own financing, and also because they are making it cheaper. If you don't bring Chinese force, how are you going to do it cheaper? And then the second issue, in a way, I see it as a limit. You know, on the short term, probably China is winning, but on the long term, I see it as a limit. Is those companies are behaving in this way not because they are better or worse than the Westerns. I think that all companies want to make money. It doesn't matter where they come from. The issue is that a Western company, if it's listed on a stock market and if it's having NGOs, you know, going around and journalists asking questions, probably they would be much more careful about decisions they take. On the Chinese side, there is no limits because, you know, no one in China no newspaper in China or no stock exchange, you know, your action is not going to collapse. So I think that there's no incentive for them to change the way how they behave as they don't have any incentive in China.
Let me add one thing. I think that just to add up in my previous response, the thing that is really damaging most Chinese reputation is the issue of the very, very poor labor conditions. I was explaining the issue of inside and outside the site. But of course, in those sites, there's a number of local people that are being employed. And this is a pattern that we've seen absolutely everywhere where we've looked into, which is how comfortable the Chinese are in having a conflict situation in their investments. In Peru, for instance, the biggest iron ore project in Latin America, there's a Chinese state-owned company that has is an investor there for the last 20 years, and they've been having 20 years of rioting, violence, and all kinds of troubles. And even there's a British mining company that had problems of their own, but they finally decided to leave the country because of all the problems that were involved. And the Chinese were the ones taking over, and even they were not, they knew that they were going to inherit all those problems, you know. And well, the Chinese, I think they have, I mean, they feel very comfortable with this situation, because their mantra is the same mantra as we have in China, which is economic development.
Thank you very much, both of you, for coming. We've hit our 2 o'clock cutoff, but we would welcome, I think both of you have the time to stay around to talk to people afterwards, so please do come up afterwards. We always like to give our speakers something to remember the club by, so the next time we'll see you in club ties. Thank you all very much. We hope to see many of you again on Monday. Thank you.